Let's remember the good men and women working at Buffy's, slaving away during the holidays to make sure that your car is tip-top and in great condition. You know, when you head on over to Buffy's and drop your car off, they've got 16 locations, been around for 48 years. Why not bring them a fruitcake or something special? Bake them something and maybe go out and get some shopping done for the people at Buffy's Auto Service Centers. That seems like an extreme idea? I don't think so. Not for the good people at Buffy's Auto Service Centers. Don't spend anything less than $100 with each mechanic. You know, people tip their doormen, they tip their the valet, they tip the garbage man, right? Tom, holiday time? What are you going to do for Buffy's? Buffy's Auto Service Centers, that's what I ask you.
John, how many of us have doormen to tip?
I don't know where that came from. I don't know. In New York City, that was a big deal.
Yeah, I bet. Are we broadcasting in NYC today?
I was trying to think of anybody that I come in contact with. I don't tip my mailman. I don't tip the garbage man. You're supposed to do that, right? Huh?
I don't know.
At Christmas time, a little something, something. Is Hannah Scott going to join us?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, she's coming. Oh, she's not in the studio again. This is her new thing now. She doesn't like to come in here anymore. All right. Here we go. Here comes Hannah. Scott, where are you?
I'm in Vancouver.
Oh, Vancouver, Canada?
Washington. Oh. Heading back today, but that's all right. I got everything covered.
Good. So this is big news. Governor Inslee, and I looked up that apparently the state of Washington lags behind so many states. I think it might be somewhere near the bottom as far as the number of people that have mental illness and the amount of money that we spend in order to service them.
Absolutely. You know, and we've been ordered to do more for years. Just in recent years, the state has invested $900 million to deal with a lot of major issues, especially when we're talking about the state hospitals, Western State Hospital in particular, where there's been major safety issues, staffing shortages, a variety of other problems. We just lost federal funding for that. It's costing the state about $50 million a year because we lost the accreditation because of issues there. Earlier this year. So everyone that I've talked to, state lawmakers, the governor throughout the year have all agreed that they were going to make mental health a top priority as we move into this next legislative session. It's been described to me as the next McCleary for the legislature this year. So it's a big, big deal. So Governor Inslee yesterday came out with this proposal. He wants to invest $675 million more dollars into this to try to deal with the problem. One of the biggest issues is long waits at both the state hospitals, Eastern and Western State.
We have people who are ready to discharge from Western Eastern State Hospital, but there's no place for them to go to have any sort of supported housing. So we have this huge blockage in the system. And as a result for that, we can't get people into our state hospitals. And a result of that, we have people languishing in our county and city jails who can't get into our state hospitals. We need to unplug this system.
So part of the way he wants to deal with that is investing millions in a variety of new community-based smaller facilities, some of which would be run by the state.
We want to provide mental health care system closer to where people live, in their communities, places that are closer to their places of work, to their friends, to their family, to their churches, rather than just large institutions. And we plan to do that by opening a number of state-operated, mostly, centers.
Now, that is going to be an issue for some Republicans. Many Republicans really liked the announcements he made yesterday, the investments he was talking about, but those community-based facilities being run by the state is a snag.
I'm very concerned about making these all state run because I don't think that make it for us a system where we can be innovative, develop some really good best practices in this area. So I'm going to probably be pushing back pretty hard on that. I think each region should decide whether they want a state-run facility.
That's Republican State Senator Steve O'Bann, by the way. Senator John Braun also echoing those sentiments. So expect that to need to be worked out as we move forward. Another investment is a brand new state hospital. There's money in this budget proposal for just the beginning of the design of that hospital, a 500-bed facility that would eventually replace Western State. And that's an issue that Republicans have as well. There's a lot of really great stuff in here, though, that should help both get your civil commitment patients, which has been part of the governor's vision, a five-year plan he announced earlier this year, out of these state hospitals into more community-based facilities. But they're also going to have to talk to those communities and make sure they're going to want those facilities, you know, in their backyard.
Hmm. This is a long time coming. If you do look at the big numbers of where we are and since we've been so far behind. And then there's also the additional cost of what society bears when somebody has a mental illness. What's the number you've seen, Tom? Is it 1 out of 4 people have some type of mental illness? Is that what it is, I think, in the general population?
Yeah, I mean, I think that might even be low. It all depends on how broadly one of, if you have episode depression episodes, people can go through depression and come out of it the other end. But if you just if you calculate everybody who's ever had any kind of a mental illness or mental issues, that certainly is a it's a high number.
And sometimes you get substance abuse issues fall under this mental health umbrella as well. So it can be pretty broad definition in our state. But again, something they're hoping to work out.
Yeah. One of the interesting innovations, I think, of this proposal is this idea of working with the University of Washington to start a new teaching hospital. The idea is that the teaching hospital will end up turning out people that will be mental health workers. The idea is that right now there's such a shortage of that. If you have a teaching hospital focusing on behavioral health, that will, you know, also help alleviate the strain because we just don't have enough people working in that field.
Mm-hmm. That's an awesome partnership, and it does have bipartisan support. All the Republicans I talked to were really on board with that. The governor is very excited about it. The UW is very excited about it, and that will make sure that they train these staff to stay here in our state. And also that partnership would have also provide some beds, needed beds down the line as well. And the staff shortage is huge. That's a major problem at Western State. Earlier this year, yeah. One of these smaller community-based facilities I just mentioned did open up in Everett. And when I talked to that operator there, they said, we're open, but we can't take any of these civil commitment patients because we don't have any staff. So it's a big problem.
Mm. Okay. Another tricky thing, you mentioned this right at the end of your report,
Hannah,
is that the siding, I think, could be tough. Just like how many communities? It's one thing where you have everybody lumped together at Eastern State and or Western State. This is, I think, it's a good idea to get everyone out that's at these things out in their communities so they're closer to their family and their churches and their local organizations. But I'm wondering if there's going to be resistance from the communities. For citing of that are basically mental health issues, is that going to be something? I don't hear any. It's not a partisan issue, but I just think it could be tough to convince somebody that they want a community mental health facility in their community.
And that's something Governor Inslee addressed that yesterday, saying, they want to talk to these communities, make sure that they can get on board, but they need to. There's a layer of stuff going on with that particular issue. State has kind of a fair share law where you're supposed to take people who are mentally ill from their community. If they go to one of the state hospitals, they're supposed to go back into their community for treatment when they get released. That's not always happening now. Lakewood is a big example of this where it's close to Western State, so they're funneling a lot of these people into facilities there. Mm. That's something else that will come up this session. But the bottom line is everyone is saying, look, there's mental health patients and from communities all over the state. Everybody needs to do their part. The one in Everett I just mentioned, there was some pushback in that community. They didn't necessarily want it there, right there near all the businesses and housing, but it's there. So I don't know that anyone can stop it.
Okay. Hannah, do you forgive Tom for not remembering your name?
I do.
All right.
It's
thanks,
okay.
Thanks, Hannah.
You're welcome.
Sorry, Tom. I hope that wasn't uncomfortable for you. Okay. I mean, I should talk, right? I remember one time somebody came in here. I won't say who it was. That works here. Has worked here for a long time, and I didn't know the person's name. And I had to write down on a piece of paper and run over to Patrick. Who is this?
Right.
Patrick's like, huh? I said, who's who is that person? Did you know that I did that?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm aware. And the funny thing was, it was me.
Hey, Nikki Haley is stepping down, leaving the UN. Last thing she tried to do was trying to get Hamas to be described as a terrorist organization. Of course, the other terrorist organization, which runs the UN, said, no, we're not going to vote on that. So she was kind of hurt by her last attempt to make some changes there at the UN. But she steps down after doing a pretty good job of being the velvet glove in the fist technique that she would often use. She was a tough gal, and she said that she used Donald Trump's personality to allow her to get more things done. She was on the Today Show talking about it.
Is it true that you use the president's unpredictable rhetoric to our advantage diplomatically.
If I needed to pick up the phone and say, this is what I'm going to do, you know, are you good with this or this? We kind of partnered in that. And so he would like ratchet up the rhetoric. And then I'd go back to the ambassadors and say, you know, he's pretty upset. I can't promise you what he's going to do or not. But I can tell you if we do these sanctions, it will keep him from going too far.
So you were playing good cop, bad cop.
I was trying to get the job done. And I got the job done by being truthful, but also by letting him be unpredictable and not showing our cards.
What is this technique known as, Tom?
The velvet glove technique.
No. Remember this? This was Nixon. Remember they did this with Nixon and Kissinger? It was called the Madman Theory. The Madman Theory, right.
Yes,
and I think Kissinger did it with Nixon. He's like, look, I don't know. This guy might start bombing. We better do something.
Right.
And Nixon let him do that to spread it out there. It's the same sort of thing. You go to buy a car. Yeah, let me go talk to my manager. The guy goes in the other room, has a couple of coffee. Yeah, my manager says that's probably the best he can do for you on something like that. You know, so it's the idea. I'm going to go in and talk to somebody. I'm going to come back out again. She was also asked if the timing for her exit had to do with the Mueller investigation.
It would appear to some that the special counsel's investigation is growing closer to the president. Did you say, maybe this is a good time for me to
not at all.
Not
I have that. Not had any time to even pay attention to the Mueller investigation. I have
not at all.
I have tuned it out. I can't do anything about it. The one thing I've said publicly, and I strongly believe, is I think the investigation, if it's going forward, should go forward. But they need to hurry up for the good of the country. They need to hurry up and let us know what they know.
President says it's a witch hunt.
We'll find out.
Yeah. Will she run in 2024, Tom? Yes or no?
Yes.
I have no idea. I think a lot of people have talked about what I may be doing in the future. But I can promise you, Michael and I have never talked about running for president, what that would look like, anything like that, because our lives have been such a fun surprise. The only decision I've made right now is that I'm looking forward to sleeping in.
All right, there we go.
So what I think, the reason I think she comes off so well, she's one of the few people that are leaving the Trump administration without pockmarks from having withstood the president. She talks about, she was asked about how she dealt with his, you know, his bombastic rhetoric and how she, you know, how she managed to sort of avoid that. And she says, I just refuse to get into the drama. He says, I'm disciplined enough to know not to get into the drama. That she, what she normally did was that she said the reasonable thing when the president gets into all kinds of international trouble, instead of defending Trump, she would just come out with a very straightforward comment that most of us, whether Democrat or Republican, could agree with. And she, without sort of disagreeing with the president, she managed to say something straightforward enough that we could agree with her. And since she was the U.N. ambassador or U.N. representative for the administration, I think it actually helped Trump. Like the way she handles this whole Khashoggi thing, she thinks this is terrible what happened. We ought to be outraged. But it's her use of rhetoric that is so different from Trump's. And it's the rhetoric that if Trump adopted, I think he would even be more effective. Because ultimately, everyone agrees, right and left, that we need some kind of cooperation with Saudi Arabia. But that doesn't mean that we can't condemn the crown prince who is behind it and really call him out. She calls him out without necessarily changing our policy. The president refused to go there. I think the president could pick up a few pointers from Nikki Haley about how to deal with some of these controversial issues. That's why I think she'll make I don't know if a great presidential nominee, but she could be a good one, given how she just has this natural way with her rhetoric is very natural and reasonable sounding.
When she was the governor, there was the
South Carolina,
and the big thing about, I think it was either the Confederate flag or it was also a statue. And remember how she stood up and she sort of made sure that she had compromise on both sides. She recognized the people that felt the Confederate flag was really not necessarily a racist symbol, but it was about symbolizing and showing some sort of support for those that had lost their life during the war. She recognized that. I think she handled it really well. People started to understand, who's this Nikki Haley gal? And how does she like to get things done? She was well-respected in South Carolina. She steps in, does her great work in the U.N. I think she's in a great great position. People would be very, very likely to be able to find her to be a palatable Republican to run. Of course, she won't run against Trump in 2024. She lets Trump do whatever he wants to do, and then she gets to come in there because she does not want to have to battle. I can't. Have you heard or read anything about anybody wanting to run against the president from the Republican side?
So the only person that's being projected is John Kasich. In other words, John Kasich is so outside the Trump norm, and he's got appeal, a kind of a centrist appeal, you know, in the Democratic Party. If, let's say, the Democrats go very left, and Trump, you know, is the only guy standing on the right, I see Kasich maybe not as a third party, but maybe as a savior of the Republican Party against Trump. But no, I think. Most candidates, it's hard to run against your incumbent. Ted Kennedy tried to run against Jimmy Carter when he was a incumbent, and Jimmy Carter lost the election, but he didn't lose the election to Ted Kennedy.
Deadpool, I saw the movie, saw part of it on a plane, watched half of it, and then I got tired of the fact that it was so cutesy, and I was also mad at you because you liked it, so then I had to watch something else.
Hilarious. Deadpool 2. You know why I think you might not have appreciated Deadpool Deadpool 2, John? Is because it's full of cultural references, which you don't get.
Right. I mean, and they're layered, one on top of the other.
Yes, exactly.
And so if the first one, you don't get the first one, the second one doesn't work.
Right.
Here's Deadpool defending Nickelback. I guess they're putting it in here because Nickelback.
This is clever.
Okay. You'll have to explain to me why this is clever. It's Deadpool defending Nickelback to Fred Savage.
I've had it with all this Nickelback hating, right? You think that makes you cool? With the cool kids in school, Fred?
No, it just makes me right.
It doesn't.
They're overproduced, formulaic, ear garbage.
Oh, really? You know who might disagree with that? Facts. 50 million albums worldwide.
Boom.
11th best-selling musical act of all time. Billboard's most successful rock group of the last decade. 6 Grammy nominations, 12 Juno Awards. Those count. 6 Billboard Music Awards, 2 American Music Awards, 1 People's Choice Award, Canadian, and a partridge in a pear tree.
Sorry. I thought we were just having fun. I didn't realize it was
You gotta say, you were nicer as a kid.
Tired of living like a blind man. Sick inside of a sense of feeling. This is how you remind me.
This is how you remind me of what I really am. This is how you remind me of what I really am.
This is terrible. You know what, Tom? You'll like this. At auctions, I throw Deadpool under the... I throw Nickelback under the bus all the time.
Uh-huh.
So I play music at auctions, and if the bidding stops and somebody's thinking that they want to spend $70,000 or whatever, $100,000, stop. I said, I'll tell you what, you stop and think about it while I play this classic song from Nickelback. And then we play Nickelback, and the audience boos. I mean, they're screaming to put additional peer pressure on the poor guy that's at $75,000 or $100,000. And then he bids again, and then it goes back to the other guy, goes back to that guy again. He pauses again. I said, I'm sorry, that is not fair to play that song. I'll play this one instead. Even a whole more horrible Nickelback song, and the crowd screams, bid for crying out loud, please, stop it. And Nickelback under the bus, we make money for charity. How about that? You like that?
Yep, very good. And by the way, Ryan Reynolds is Canadian, Nickelback is Canadian, he's coming to the Canadians' defense. And the setup for that was that Deadpool, he says, I'm a Marvel character, you should like me. And he says, yeah, but you're made by Fox rather than the Marvel movie company. He says, that would be like the Beatles being played by Nickelback.
Oh,
that's what set it up.
That's a story. So many layers, inside. So nuanced.
That's right. Brilliant.
So brilliant. Right back. Online Trading Academy text line, 98973. I met a bunch of folks last night at the show, Tom, and I sent them my phone number so they can text me. One guy had an incredible story. Just before the Oso landslide hit, his wife divorced him. He lost his job. She took all of his possessions and his car and then the landslide came down and I think it wiped out his house. And then within a month, he got a new job. He got a new car. His whole life just completely flipped around the other way. It was absolutely nuts, the story. And I said, does anybody talk to you? Has anybody here at Cairo done a follow-up? He said, no. And I said, okay, well, here's my phone number, and we'd love to be able to chat with you. It's amazing when you get a chance to hear about people's stories, their incredible turnaround stories. Whenever I hear things like that, I kind of want to start to talk about religion, because I'm always like, so why do you think this happens? If there's a plan or is not a plan, is everything just chaos and things just happen randomly and there's no way that you can possibly determine what's going to happen in your life? Or is there some force, is there some energy out there that is directing the progress or the destruction of things? And the idea is we get into talking about religion. In this case, the are you there, God? It's me, Alexa. Tech and religious leaders ponder the future of AL together.
Yeah, for AI.
AI, I'm sorry.
First off, I assume that he credited his personal turnaround to the Tom and Curly show. That's why he was addressing you last night, right?
Absolutely.
We improve people's lives.
We are there
every
for
day.
You. We are there for you. Yes.
Yes. But in terms of those, I love this idea. This is a conference held at Seattle Pacific University about artificial intelligence and faith and whether they are aligned or enemies. And it's interesting, some people see it as the wave of the future to make us more faith-based or more religious-oriented, and others see it literally as the Antichrist. The concept of, as they call it, the AI Almighty is the discussion under foot. And I do think it raises all sorts of compelling issues. The idea here is that if AI can make us can make information more valuable to us, if we have an AI, artificial intelligence, that can actually talk to us and counsel us. Remember, we did this story a few months ago about, you know, can artificial intelligence actually take the role of therapist,
yeah,
talk us through these kinds of things? Well, in another version, talk us through our religious crises.
Mm-hmm.
It talk us through these kinds of aspects. Is that a good or is it a negative? They had a lot of different presentations. They're doing a lot of experiments. They wanted to see if they could have artificial intelligence create a sermon. So they fed in this famous, I studied him in grad school in literature. Jonathan Edwards was a famous Puritan preacher, and they fed his entire works into this system and then had him create, you know, basically had the AI create out of whole cloth that was stitched by Jonathan Edwards to create a sermon and see if it would pass muster. And they said sometimes it was nonsensical, but a lot of times it was indistinguishable from his other sermons, that this could be a way of promulgating the faith.
Yeah.
At the same time, the concern is that it could replace our faith.
Yes.
In other words, that people could transplant their faith in a higher being to faith in a technological creation, and that's the pitfalls for faith-based communities as well.
Christopher Lim, who is a former Amazon engineer, he gave a talk called AI, the Kingdom, where he talked about the kind of implications of artificial intelligence has on religious people.
You know, the really cool thing is that AI brings up questions about purpose, design, morality, ethics, consciousness, what does it mean to be human, and so much more. All these people who maybe would not want to care about the gospel or hear about Jesus or anything or religious stuff, they're asking the exact same questions that have mattered from the very beginning. What does it even mean to be human? What does it mean to have a purpose and to give purpose to an artificial agent? Who gets to define that purpose? Right? Who gets to? And so all these questions are just percolating in our minds. It's a ripe opportunity, actually, to be talking about the very same things.
Yeah, he also speculated about whether there could be AI in heaven.
You know, AI researchers, science fiction dreamers, they're basically putting themselves in God's shoes. They may or may not be playing God, but they're putting themselves in their shoes. Like, how do we keep our creations from rebelling against us? And if they do rebel, what are we going to do? That's kind of what they're asking, and that's kind of what we learn about from God. He created us, and we rebelled, and we see his plan of redemption about what he did for us. And so there's all these parallels, basically. I don't have the answers right now, but I just call them out as things to think about. And what is it? You know, is there a place for AI in the kingdom of God? Could you have Jarvis in heaven, right? People ask about questions about pets, like when a pet go to heaven or something like that. Well, you could also ask, could you have Jarvis in heaven? And what would that mean? What would AI redeemed look like?
How about that?
It's and again, as he mentions, he says, I don't have any answers to this. I'm just raising
just
these,
a lot of questions.
These questions. Right. And that's exactly what it is. It's a bit like, you know, in the movie Her, postulates that somebody could fall in love with a computing system that he just carries around in his pocket, Joaquin Phoenix's character. Mm-hmm. And whether that's believable or not, and it certainly is believable, you can have very human interactions with a computer, mm-hmm. and you end up the emotions that we all bring with us, we can impute to a computer. And the same thing with if you have a love of God, if you have something that's that you can respond to as a person, you can respond to that technological creation as a God as well. And if it speaks in the language of God, mm-hmm. you know, like biblical stuff and all this, I could easily see somebody falling, not necessarily like being duped, but just sort of falling in love with a person who isn't really a person, or with a God who isn't really a God.
Well, then you don't want to put false gods before me, so you'd be breaking one of the Ten Commandments. Okay. The thing that you're building is just like a golden calf or something that you'd be worshiping. AI is created by humans, and humans were created by God, so God ultimately gets his name on the copyright on AI, correct?
There you go. I mean, that's certainly a rationale that can be defended.
So since three out of four people in the world are associated with some type of religion, there's a really interesting story that talks about, they did an experiment. Does religion make you frugal, or does religion cause you to open or close your pocketbook? And they did two or three different experiments. We don't need to talk about the specifics of it. But the outcome was, it seemed like if people were exposed to religion, they were less likely to kind of treat themselves to something at a supermarket that was not on their list to buy.
That's right. It has a conserving or conservative take that religious people tend to tend to splurge less. And again, we're talking about a grocery store. We're not talking about a department store or a car floor. But in a grocery store, they would have religious people. They'd have people go in and they'd purchase various things, and they'd ask them about their religious identification, you know, mm-hmm. religious or not religious. And then they would go the other way, and they'd have people watch a religious oriented video. And after seeing that, what are your grocery buying tendencies? And it turns out that even for the people that are non-religious, if they've seen something about God, like a 30-minute video about religion and God, they also were very strict. And one of the things they said, so why is that about that? And they just say that the idea is that you value about things in life, if you appreciate things in life, you're not wasteful and spendy. Then that is kind of a secret message. It's not the main message of the gospel, but it's one of those messages that makes you aware of what's more valuable in life, and you don't spend willy-nilly.
Right. You don't need to seek something outside of yourself in order to bring you joy, satisfaction. All those other things come from within, and understanding that you're a child of God.
That's right. They say this has economic fallout. If you're planning on putting a little grocery store someplace, don't put it next to a church.
We're right back. All right. You're supposed to attribute something. If somebody has a unique phrase or has a point of view that they put out in the press or over the air somehow, and you're a writer, you have to attribute it, right, Tom? If somebody puts something together like a movie review, if you're borrowing a phrase from another critic, you need to say, as Tom Tagney would say, right?
Yes.
In this case, this guy, do you know who this is? Have you ever heard of this guy before?
Yes. He's one of the guys that's aggregated on Rotten Tomatoes. So I've occasionally read his reviews. He writes for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, so it's not a regular person I read, but occasionally when I'm looking at Rotten Tomatoes and looking at various reviews of people, I've run across his stuff, and I thought he was a decent writer, and it turns out that maybe there is a reason for how decent his writing is. For 30 years, he has been cribbing other people's language, and most notably, you know, they always say that real artists, you know, like hack artists borrow and real artists steal. Well, he was stealing from the best.
Yes.
Pauline Kael is probably considered the greatest American film critic, you know, of the last 50 years. And he was caught. Somebody, a reader of his sent an email to his company saying a 2009 review. So this is a review that's almost 20 years old that Covert wrote. He cribbed a phrase from Pauline Kael in 1974. This is somebody who's clearly done a deep dive.
Yeah.
And the phrase was self-glorifying masochistic mush.
Right.
Now, by using those four words together, I dare say nobody else has ever put those four words together. So this isn't just something that he's happened to. Oh, isn't that funny? 40 years ago, someone used the same four specific words. Mm-hmm. But if you doubt that, and maybe one instance in 30 years doesn't make, you know, that's not really grounds for a divorce, so to speak. But they went, the editor started searching in. They found eight other examples of him in his reviews over the years. And most recently, you think, well, that was so long ago. It's amazing. Isn't there a statute of limitations? In a review that he just wrote this past November on a movie called Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is literally about somebody who pretends to be writing somebody else's words. He writes, there's breathtaking craft and control in her performance, but not once do you sense the tools at work.
Right.
That's cribbed from a year earlier, a review of a very different movie by a guy in The Hollywood Reporter. There's breathtaking craft and control in the performance, but not once do you sense the tools at work.
Right. What would cause somebody to do this? The guy's been doing it for 30 years. You figure can he turn a phrase on his own? Did he just kind of get weak or lazy? The fact that the internet is an easy way to catch somebody who's doing this, it's also a great way to be able to get some of this stuff. How does somebody who has to write reviews every single couple of weeks end up doing something like that?
Well, you know what's, he must do it. He must write his reviews. My hunch is that maybe he like writes out particular phrases that he really thinks are pertinent. I mean, I don't do this, but I'm trying to imagine he's not going to be going through a 1974 review of Pauline Kael and then go, oh yeah, I can use that for this week's review. But I'm wondering if he maybe was a collector of famous reviews or popular reviews or reviews that he thought were so succinct, and then he ends up cribbing them. Mm-hmm. The key is we all live in fear that we're copying somebody else's words, because there are only so many times you can say something is clever or, you know, whatever. But never, not in this kind of stringing 19 words together in a sentence. There's no way this guy wasn't cheating. He admits to making blunders and he's resigned. I don't know why.